This is George Hayhoe, Editor-in-Chief of the IEEE Transactions on Professional Communication. I'm happy to be talking today with Dr. Karen Shriver. Karen is currently a researcher in information design, plain language, and people-centered communications. She was a professor of rhetoric and document design at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. She's taught at the University of Utrecht, the University of Washington, the University of Stellenbosch, and recently at the University of Gothenburg. Her book, Dynamics in Document Design, published by John Wiley in 1997, has been called a classic in information design and technical communication. Her research interests include designing compelling communications for busy people using diverse media. She is currently working on a book about evidence-based information design and plain language, and she's received 12 national and international awards for her work.
Welcome, Karen. One thing that surprised me in your article is how early the U.S. government became involved in the plain language movement. In fact, the very first event on your timeline is the 1942 Federal Reports Act. At the same time, we see lack of progress or even steps backward at several points. Ronald Reagan rescinded Jimmy Carter's executive orders, and the George W. Bush administration failed to build on progress made under his predecessor. You end your article in 2015. What do you think the immediate future holds for plain language in the U.S.?
Well, I think, first of all, thank you very much, George, for inviting me to be part of this podcast. I'm very excited to get a chance to elaborate on some of the ideas that came up in the article. This question, I think that the immediate future is bright for plain language. I think some of the impetus is coming from a gradual realization that clear communication can be good for business and government. And it doesn't hurt that the Plain Writing Act of 2010 is now law. Some of the energy for plain language is coming from a pushback against the current administration, which has been taking steps to hide information by, for example, banning the use of certain words or phrases, such as global warming or evidence-based. We plain language people can only believe that George Orwell must be shouting from his grave, "I warned you about politicians trying to make lies sound truthful." Now people in the government are rebranding lies as alternative facts. I think in the immediate future, I predict some backsliding at the government level. I'm thinking about what's been happening over the last month to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. As I reported in my paper, the CFPB, as it's called, under the direction of Richard Cordray, was one of the best examples of plain language in action. And the current administration seems to be taking steps that will make it harder for people to get the straight story about a variety of issues related to making good financial decisions. And here I'm thinking about really everything from student loans to home mortgages to prepaid cards to payday loans. As you'll remember, under the direction of Richard Cordray, really some important advances were made in government communications, especially in the areas of home mortgages and student loans. As many of your listeners will have heard, recently Donald Trump replaced Mr. Cordray with a Mr. Mulvaney, who, according to the LA Times, plans ditching the rules at this consumer agency rather than enforcing them. It seems like he's on a mission to destroy the mission and to take the consumer out of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. I mean, he might want it to be renamed the Financial Services Protection Bureau. It just seems like he's already planning to ease the regulations for mortgage lenders and prepaid card issuers. I think that the banks are lining up because they're looking forward to a kinder and gentler CFPB for 2018, as long as the kindness goes to them and not to citizens. That said, I think that the impetus for business is getting stronger. And one of the big reasons is that so much business has moved online. And to me, this has made search and engine optimization crucial. And it means that plain language is going to play a role in how companies position themselves on the web. And people, organizations that have clear communications, I think, will be perceived as having greater credibility than those who don't. It will also be easier for people to search if they can use plain language words, and so that companies who use plain language in their content, and if that language matches what users have, they're bound to have a better SEO ranking. And so everybody wins. And I think that basically organizational culture is moving in the direction of transparency. And even though we have hit a bump in the road with the current administration, the momentum for plain language is on our side. The ClearMark Award, sponsored by the Center for Plain Language in Washington, D.C., has many entries, and government agencies are vying for their awards. Every year, they put out an annual report card grading agencies, like A to F, just like you get in school. And those grades are often picked up by the Washington Post. And the grading has become a kind of barometer of plain language in government, of how well people are doing. And some of the agency's leaders they go on the warpath if their agency scores poorly or goes down from the previous year. They want to know who didn't do a good job. And so I think the interesting thing that's been happening over the past decade and will continue to happen is that a lot of the impetus for plain language is driven internally by regular employees, not managers, but people in the trenches of the health groups, of the government agencies, even insurance companies are trying to do a better job. And surprisingly, even academics, I think, have a renewed interest in plain language, and I think this special issue will help make that happen even more so, and that they're beginning to teach plain language in their courses, and this special issue may give them some articles that they could use. And so overall, I think the future for plain language is very bright indeed.
Thank you, Karen. That's a very interesting answer, and you brought up a couple of things that will probably touch on a little bit later in the podcast. You provide a great summary of the problems that readability formulas pose in identifying plain language. Why do you think that they're still often used to evaluate texts, and what barriers prevent the creators of texts from using more reliable measurement methods?
Well, it's a tricky question, but I think that organizations still use readability formulas because they believe that judging the quality of writing needs to be easy and automated. I think because the Flesch-Kincaid readability formula was built into early versions of MS Word and gave a number for free, companies kind of bought into and expected that judging text quality should cost little or nothing. And I think that managers who evaluate the performance of these publication groups tend to want metrics and things like key performance indicators that can be tracked over time. I think they believe that if they can measure it and graph it, they can feel more confident in making claims to their superiors, all the while not realizing they might be measuring the wrong thing. I think this idea of tracking and graphing text features has been made more seductive by software companies that emphasize one-pass batch processing of websites, Word documents, or PDFs. I'm thinking of the Aqualynxes, the Visible Thread, StyleWriter, organizations that have created software built on the original readability formulas and then have taken them one step further by allowing more of consolidation and more micro detail of what your metrics are. So these organizations are doing a much better job than Word because they allow people to see changes in text features over time. And while I think the text features are relevant, they fail to tell the whole story. The whole story software companies don't want you to worry about. While they might tell you that the number of hard words you used went down last year, they can't tell you if your content actually improved last year. And there's a big difference there. There's a kind of false security in having a graph. And I think that while I have done a lot of work on building graphs, sometimes I wonder about how they're used. Many writers who use readability formulas argue, well, it's a good first step. But the problem is it's usually the last step. If we have to ask ourselves, you know, if we get a good score, does that really mean we have the right content? When we focus on the numerical characteristics of the content, we run the risk of getting a great score on lousy content. Could that happen? Definitely it could happen. As I show in the article, you can take a text, scramble the sentences, run the readability formula on the original and scrambled versions, and wind up with the same readability score, even if the scrambled text is incoherent. When we use human-centered design methods for assessing text quality, we assess how well the content functions for the user, looking for problems of omission as well as commission, problems of visual language as well as verbal language. The readability formulas will never tell you what's missing in your content or what's wrong with your visuals. Only readers can do that. So while there's nothing wrong with using readability formulas to benchmark characteristics such as average sentence length and word complexity, the formulas don't offer any help to guide whole text revision. And that's where the research shows that expert writers really shine. They really know how to size up a whole text and assess how to go in on it, how to make it better, how to improve it at the whole text level, at the coherence level, at the what it says level, at the content is king level. Importantly, I think that when we rely on readability as kind of the first and last step in assessing writing, we really miss opportunities to connect with our audiences. So I think that the barriers that prevent organizations from using more reliable methods are at least three. First, organizations tend to think, well, if no one's complaining about my content, then everything must be fine. But research tells us that most people won't complain. They'll simply stop reading and go away. This is especially true when there's too much content, if it looks dense and overwhelming. Readability formulas can't assess that. Second, organizations often use reliable methods for evaluating the quality of their products, but they often don't see the communication as part of the product, so they don't think that it will really influence their brand. And again, I think this assumption is incorrect because a lot of the buzz about products and services come from users talking about their experiences with, guess what, the communications. All one needs to do is to look at the reviews on Amazon or other retail sites to see how often consumers mention the quality of the manuals, the interface, the frequently asked questions, or the customer service. So there's no doubt that good communications do influence brand loyalty. And third, I think the biggest barrier to using more reliable methods is perceived cost. Although it doesn't take a lot of money to test communications, it isn't free and it doesn't come with one click. As I say in the article, you really don't have to test everything to get a sense of how well your communications are working. And there certainly is a place for intelligent, automated assistance for authors. But even the best software will not replace having real people look at your content. Organizations must resist the fallback position of merely relying on outdated methods, such as only using readability formulas.
That's a great answer. Free and easy will almost always, I think, win over expensive or costly and complex. So unfortunately, that's a fact of life, I guess.
Yes, I think it is. If they could only see the value, and I think we're beginning to see the return on investment studies that, you know, that it really will make a difference in a positive direction if you have communications that your customers can understand and value.
Right. You touched on George Orwell a little bit earlier in your answer to my first question. The final section of your article is titled From Understanding Content to Usability of Content to Trust in Content. In a time when politicians offer alternative facts and social media is rife with content that is clearly not true, how can creators of content ensure that users will trust their communications?
Well, this is a really hard question, and it's interesting because of this political moment. A few days ago, in fact, the Plain English Foundation of Australia issued its worst words and phrases of 2017, and not too surprisingly, alternative facts won the grand prize. With so much content out there that's untrue by design, the question of how to get users to trust our communications is a really hard one. Partly because people may unwittingly trust false information, and partly because it's a very hard problem that hasn't been studied that well yet. And as I said in the article, people can use plain language techniques to lie and deceive, and we as plain language practitioners and advocates have been trying to figure out how to enable users to discriminate and recognize fact from fiction. Fortunately, there's a lot of interest in this question, and lots of people are working on it from various disciplines. For example, a recent hackathon took place at Yale University, and graduate students were charged with trying to come up with some new ideas about combating alternative facts. And one group came up with a browser extension they called Open Mind. It alerts users to fake and biased stories on the web, and it helps guide them to more balanced coverage news stories. So it's a kind of a prompting extension that, you know, hey, you might want to look at this other point of view, which I think is very handy. Researchers have been looking at factors that might increase trust and enhance credibility. There are ideas that if we can build trust, perhaps we can get people to take desired actions. In some cases, that might be, you know, filling out your IRS form. In other cases, it might be buying something. So researchers have been studying things like the textual choices associated with texts that people tend to trust, such as using personal pronouns to promote a more personal tone. But while using a personal tone is appropriate in some circumstances and might help build trust, using personal pronouns doesn't create trustworthy texts. Trust is one of these slippery things that is defined by the user. It's not really a property of the content. It's something that people perceive as they listen or engage with the content. And basically, their biases and predispositions about that content or the organization that put the content out will be part of the perception. As we know, psychology tells us that when people go into something that they already think they know about, they tend to look for confirmation of ideas they already hold. And so it's really tricky to try to get somebody to turn around on an idea that they already are firm about. So in some cases, people are looking at these correlational aspects of text, trying to figure out, well, could we do that? Maybe we should do that. And other researchers are saying, well, maybe rather than studying discrete text features, maybe how about rhetorical moves, such as showing empathy with the user's point of view, or anticipating the user's questions, or making sure that the user knows where the information came from, making sure that there are citations or outward bound links that allow the user to check things out. But again, these kind of rhetorical moves, they can help build trust, but they are cues that really can influence in a positive way or a negative way, but they don't really lead your user to trust the content and make actions based on it. There's kind of a leap of faith there that we haven't really explored. This whole trust thing is exploding now because of so much in the news. But if you were kind of to look at it over the past decade, most of the work in the area has been in the area of medicine and how to build trust between medical staff and patients. And that work is finding that interactive communication is key to building trust. And of course, many organizations have picked up on this idea with asking users to contribute to forum and to provide answers to other users and to help people out. Unfortunately, many times they just leave users to flail on their own, and some of the information is worthless, and you wish that someone would step in, Adobe, and help people when they need it. But people really need a chance to speak back and ask questions, you know, before they assign trust. And the studies of the patients and doctors show that people don't trust people who they think are withholding information that they need to make a decision. And I think users are the same way. They don't trust companies who feel that they might be holding back on content. For example, it's hard to trust companies even selling simple things. For example, I was trying to get a streaming TV service a couple weeks ago, and I could not get the service to tell me whether I would be able to get local programming if I took this service. And they accidentally, on purpose, avoid telling you this because they don't have it right yet, and they don't want you not to buy it. They want you to buy it now and not wait for months. But that erodes the feeling of trust.
Absolutely.
You know, and it just makes you crazy. And you think, well, what if we were to flip the script and ask the questions, like, from the user's point of view, what are the rhetorical strategies of skilled liars that we need to be wary of? You know, liars use strategies all the time, like deflection, when the topic gets hot, change the topic, omission, just leave out what they don't need to know, discrediting, making people look like losers, as Donald Trump would say, cherry-picking examples, you know, doctors recommend. Well, how many doctors recommend?
And why?
fussiness, flattery, all sorts of things, you know, that are pretentious ways of just trying to make people think that there's something there that isn't. And as I said in the article, that the plain language advocates really have become really concerned with ethical communication. The problem is there just isn't a lot out there yet for us. But I anticipate that more researchers will turn to this critical issue over the next decade. So ask me again in 10 years, George.
Okay. I will do that. Thanks for that answer, Karen. That was really very helpful, I think, for those of us who are trying to navigate present circumstances. Your article deals only with the plain language movement in the U.S. and only with English, but I know that you've worked extensively with people around the world who are champions of plain language. Can you tell us some about what you've observed and learned from those exchanges?
Well, sure. What I've learned from these exchanges is that countries around the world are grappling with the same problems that the U.S. is dealing with, only in more pronounced ways and maybe in more nuanced ways. I have worked all over the world, but let me speak briefly about the European Union, Sweden, and South Africa. In all three contexts, the governing bodies are dealing with large numbers of immigrants entering their country in need of finding out everything from basic services, such as how to enroll my child in school, to more advanced services, such as how to set up a financial plan for retirement. The European Commission, for example, just updated its style guide for authors and translators, covering everything from how to format a list to when to use the word must. And so what I'm learning is that plain language practitioners are at the forefront of communicating clearly to these really divergent audiences, and they're trying to figure out how to solve practical problems of communication. In some countries, the problem seems much more intense than it is here because there are so many languages involved and because the government, in some cases, mandates plain language. Unlike the U.S., the constitutions of Sweden and South Africa mandate that communications from government must be in plain language, and their constitution is in plain language. What a concept, eh? a little nod to our Canadian friends who are also at the forefront of plain language. The countries around the world, including the European Union, are active in working on problems of plain language and translating multiple languages at the same time. So most of that work is coming out of departments of linguistics and translation studies, where they're marrying issues of plain language and translation. My experience is that in countries such as Sweden, they have a lot more practical experience in plain language than we do here. They've been doing it a lot longer. In fact, the Swedish Language Council, a group I worked with, has been thinking about issues of plain language and translation for decades. Even so, with the good news, that's they're all doing work. The kind of negative is the same as it is here. There is little research into the impact of various plain language strategies. This is largely related to plain language not being an official subject of research in Swedish universities or in most universities around the world. It's changing, as in Europe, most of the work in professional communication, plain language, and document design is done in departments of linguistics and language, such as the University of Gothenburg, where I was a visiting professor this past spring. They now consider plain language as an interesting area of study, and that wasn't the case even 5 years ago. And it's also changing in South Africa and the European Union. But the change like that here is very slow. And like in the US, practitioners in other countries are seeking out findings of research that bear on plain language. The practitioners around the world that I have met are hoping that someone or some group will summarize the empirical research related to plain language and tell them how it all adds up. That's my next project, I hope. They want to know about empirical studies of reading, writing, interpreting, translating, and they seek standards for plain language, especially what constitutes good plain language practices. They hope to identify standards that will apply to English texts first, mainly because English has been the lingua franca. They're caving on that, but some people didn't want that, but that has been agreed now that we want to reach for standards for English and then go to the other languages. It's really been an international interest in this. And so what has happened is three key plain language groups, Plain Language International, it's a group of plain language advocates from around the world. Clarity, it's a big legal writing advocacy group in plain legal writing. And the Center for Plain Language, a U.S. nonprofit, they've teamed up to try to tackle this problem of trying to come up with a set of common plain language practices that go beyond today's ideas about short words and short sentences. The goal is to create standards so that they can benchmark best practices. My feeling is that it probably will take another decade before the goal of developing the standards is realized, but the plans are underway. And smart people from around the world are taking slow but measured steps to make evidence-based plain language happen across languages, information channels, and media.
That's a very insightful and it sounds to me complete response. Thank you very much. I think your article begins to do a lot of the things that you say people want. So I'm glad to hear that you are kind of teeing that up as your next project. That sounds really fascinating.
Well, thank you. I've been thinking about those issues for some time now and have given several talks on them, but I just haven't had time to pull it all together. But I'm working on it, and now there's considerable pressure on me from some of my friends who won't stop. But that's okay. I'm trying to clear the deck bench here so I can work on that next. I'm trying to come up with new ideas for a book about evidence-based plain language and information design. So
sounds great.
It's coming along.
Good, good. One last question, and this is kind of looking back toward the beginning of your career and what you think the impact of at least part of that has been. You were one of the research directors of Carnegie Mellon University's Communication Design Center, one of three sites of the Document Design Project in 1979. What was it like to be involved in those efforts, and what do you think is the biggest legacy of the Document Design Project that survives today?
That's really an interesting question for me that no one has asked, and I'm so glad that you did. It's really exciting for me to think back on that time because it was such a delightful period of my life, and as you'll know, the Document Design Project started in 1979, and President Carter had just signed an executive order on plain language. So the Document Design Project came about at a very opportune time. And while it only lasted 3 years, It spawned two major centers. One was the Document Design Center at the American Institutes for Research in Washington, and that was led by plain language pioneer Ginny Reddish. And the other was, of course, the Communication Design Center at Carnegie Mellon, led by Erwin Steinberg and John Hayes, two faculty members. These two centers lasted for more than a decade, and that was well beyond the project. And they had a huge influence on technical communication and the design of computer documentation in the 1980s. The legacy survives today because documentation today is both user-oriented and task-oriented, and it was not before this project. When I think back on that document design project, there were three big pieces of it. One was research, a second was technical assistance to government agencies, and the third was developing new curricula and academic programs. Each of the facets of that project has a surviving legacy. Let me just say a little bit about each because I think it's kind of interesting. First, a little bit about the research legacy. Although there were people studying writing, such as John Hayes and Linda Flower, they were doing research on writing process at the time and developed, as everyone knows, the first cognitive model of the writing process. No one had pulled together the research from many disciplines. The Document Design Project did that through a book called Document Design, A Review of the Relevant Research. There were also many technical reports, chapters in books, talks, and conference presentations. In fact, my students and I did a big annotated bibliography of what we knew about the design of computer documentation at the time. Keep in mind that at that time, the growth of technology was just exploding. In fact, we had Steve Jobs and Bill Gates vying for position at Carnegie Mellon about who would put the first computers in Carnegie Mellon's classrooms. Of course, Carnegie Mellon wanted everything. So before we knew it, there were clusters of IBMs and Apples all over campus. And we at the Communication Design Center were documenting those early technologies, even writing the documentation for the Apple Lisa. I have to say that the approach that was developed by the Document Design Project, which was to look at users rather than ourselves, rather than other experts, rather than people who designed the software or the hardware, but actually going to people, was a great legacy. And it started me on my own personal journey of user-centered design. And I'm sure that John Hayes would agree with that, and so would Ginny Reddish. Another piece of the Document Design Project was this technical assistance thing that we were supposed to do with the government agencies. And during the project, the members of the Document Design Project, particularly people at the American Institutes of Research, led by Ginny Reddish, they provided workshops and on-site training in plain language to government agencies. And importantly, they created some of the first plain language examples, some of the first befores and afters, which now we kind of take it for granted. People think that everybody has had these examples forever. Well, they didn't. Ginny Reddish, for example, did a usability study of marine radio rules for the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission. And she and other people on her team created these examples and took them from agency to agency who wanted to know about plain language. And without the funding that went into the Document Design Project, it would have been difficult to create those examples because it was too early. Government agencies didn't get it yet. They didn't understand it. They didn't know why it was a good idea. They just heard from the government maybe they should do it. And they certainly wouldn't have funded it. So the fact that those early examples existed were part of why Ginny Reddish, for example, was invited to speak to writers at Washington State And that led into a big plain language initiative in Washington State during the 1990s. And the Washington State program inspired other states, such as Minnesota. And both Washington and Minnesota still have governor's executive orders requiring plain language in all government and state communications. So it's a kind of a snowball effect that one thing led to another, but it all started back at this document design project. A third piece of that was the curricula. And Carnegie Mellon took the lead in developing new curricula in plain language and document design when Richard Young in 1980 started graduate programs in professional writing, technical writing, rhetoric, and document design. Those programs at the MA and PhD level went on to become some of the best in the country. And the document design project played a major role in thinking about those programs, because the faculty members who developed them realized that the work they had been doing for the project, hey, this had many implications and unanswered questions, and there was stuff that they could teach and research for years to come. One of the lasting legacies of the document design project, I have to say, is the book Guidelines for Document Designers. That book took the research that was available, that they had consolidated in the research book, and put it into the form of guidelines. And that book is still used, and it's currently available on the government website, plainlanguage.gov. Let me say just two last things about the document design project, and I'll close. First, the document design project put a focus on user-centered design before Don Norman called it that. We were testing forms, manuals, regulations, and such, and we were committed to the concept of iterative design and to the idea of a design process based on real user engagement. We were also doing research on readability, and yes, on the usefulness or lack thereof of readability formulas. That emphasis on usability and on the evaluation of tools for writers had tremendous trickle down, both for students and for companies they worked for. Carnegie Mellon students helped to start the usability labs at Microsoft, Apple, DEC, IBM, and Sony. Not all of them still exist, but Carnegie Mellon people were around at the beginning, and the document design project really played a vital role in laying the groundwork for making that happen. But the impact was not only for big companies, but many smaller ones and sites where technical communicators worked. And last but not least, I think the legacy of the document design project is all the younger people who have been influenced by the work that they've read, by the conferences where they heard people like Jenny Reddish talking about her work. It's been inspiring to them, and I think that it helped them want to be part of the field. Some of it led to students wanting to take master's and PhD degrees and go on past the BA and BS, but fundamentally it inspired a whole generation to appreciate that evidence-based technical communication and plain language and information design and user experience is really the way to go.
Thank you, Karen, not only for that last answer, which I think was brilliant, but for your willingness to be with us today and talk about your article and movement that you've been such an important part of.
Well, thank you very much, George. It's been a real pleasure, and I'm hoping that you'll get lots of listeners to your podcast and that the issue itself will stand as one of the things that you're most proudest that you're most proud of as an editor.
Well, thanks, Karen. I am